And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm here in the host seat because it's movie day, and I'm with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM, where we bring you movie reviews, and my fellow film critics are sitting around the table with me, and they include...
This is Loie Lockerbie. I freelance for the Kansas City Star, KCActive.com, and SuchACritic.com.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
We will be reviewing some films that have come up over the last few weeks, and we'd like you to chime in. Join us on the conversation at 816-235-2888. What have you seen that's really stood out that you would recommend? We want to hear your recommendations. And what made you dash for the exit? Let us know what to avoid. You can serve a public service here by helping out your fellow listeners. So give us a call, 816-235-2888. Or you can also tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be looking to hear from you very soon. There have been a lot of movies that have opened up, and some of them have touched on a topic that we'll be talking about in the second half of the show, and that is the Manic Pixie Dream Girl Syndrome. For those of you who may not be familiar with that term, it was applied back in 2005 to the movie Elizabethtown. Critic Nathan Rabin came up with that term, and it has kind of caught fire. There's even been a novel with that title, and a lot of people have used that to explain a cliched trope in film that is a young woman who only serves to help the male character with his life progression. She's lively, she's fun, she's happy-go-lucky. And she helps pull him out of his doldrums. And this has become a standard and kind of cliched trope.
So we'd Our eyes are rolling upwards.
Yes. There have been a lot of those.
She needs medication.
That could be
she
as
should
well.
Be in jail.
are screenwriters who are male just not able to write full-blooded female characters? That's a good question. So we'd like to get your feedback on that as well in the second half of the show. But first of all, we're going to be talking about some of the big openings. And one of them that comes out today is a very interesting over-the-top sci-fi action thriller called Lucy.
Lucy is a blast to watch. Along with Snowpiercer, it's one of the more visually inventive, adventurous films to come along in a while. And, of course, it has Scarlett Johansson, which is 50% of the interest in the picture, as far as I'm concerned, at least that much. She is a young lady who, it's too complicated to explain, has acquired inside her body a kind of drug. This is apparently related to some sort of a substance that's secreted in the fetus of a child at a certain age that empowers the body to grow bones. Have we heard of this?
No.
MPH4, I think it's called. Or is that MPDG? That's another topic. So Lucy has been acquiring now formidable intelligence and mental capacities that take her far beyond the assumed 10% of our mental capabilities that all of us have attained. And so she becomes a superhero. She's a supergirl, not based on brawn so much, but based more on intelligence. It's too bad she doesn't use her intelligence instead of her brawn, but that's the idea, at least. She's super smart. And along the way, there are some bad guys that are trying to get to her to reacquire this mysterious substance that is taking her into orbit, as it were. And so we have a series of confrontations as she steadily acquires 10%, 20%, then 70%, 80%, and maybe even 100%. of her total powers. What will that lead her to? What kind of evolutionary process will happen? Well, I can just telegraph in advance, that by the time we get to the end of the picture, we've come to a kind of Stanley Kubrick 2001 in reverse, but I won't take it any farther than that. It is great fun to watch. Johansson she's riveting. She has a kind of power of silence that makes her character actually convincing, as far as I was concerned. And there are some set pieces, special effects sequences, that are amazing, including a fast ride through the Paris streets that is unlike anything I think I can honestly say I've ever seen. And it makes the trippy light show at the end of 2001 look like, you know, romper room or something. I really like Lucy, as improbable as it all is, as silly as it all is. The fun factor gives it a 4 for me, believe it or not.
4 out of 5 from John for Lucy. How about you, Loie?
Well, it's one of those movies that sort of overlays a certain level of science, or at least sciencey sounding jargon, which is seems to be very common these days with these kind of films. Of course, it's all nonsense. The whole 10% of the brain thing's debunked for decades now. But it does make for an interesting setup. And Scarlett Johansson's fantastic. I mean, she has to carry the movie, and she does it exceptionally well, especially as, you know, she starts out as just a very normal person. You know, she's a student. She's, you know, just wants to go study for her finals or whatever. And then all of a sudden she finds herself being transformed into practically a superhero. And so it's very interesting. And Luc Besson, the director, also did The Fifth Element. So it's got that kind of over-the-top visual style. And, yeah, the car chase is great. It's one of the more sort of epic car chases I've seen in a while. So I don't think it's quite as successful as John does. I think it just gets a little too silly in places.
Mm-hmm.
But
agreed.
I could give it a 3.5 easily, yeah.
Yeah, I could too. That's the rating that I'm going to give it. It's very entertaining. You know, it's completely loony. It gets more implausible with each passing scene, but you don't care because it isn't riveting. And I will warn people that it is very violent. It's gratuitously violent, and it earns that R rating as a result. So if that doesn't bother you, then this is something that I think action junkies will find they can get a fix on.
Interestingly enough, Morgan Freeman wanders in from his role in Transcendence,
yes,
carrying
right.
the same role with him in
exactly.
this film.
Mm-hmm. Now exposition
he's
man.
Yeah, he's an expert on human intelligence. I might disagree with Loie, though, that we have attained much more than 10% of our human mental faculties. Look around you.
Yeah, well.
But you're right. That has been debunked.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more
I'm
about
quoting
that.
Neurologists.
That's yeah. right. And that's yeah, right. Lucy, rated R. Let's talk about another sci-fi film that opened up a couple of weeks ago and is doing very well at the box office and I think is a very smart thriller as well. It's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yeah. This turned out extremely well. I was pleasantly surprised by Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is the original reboot of this that came out a couple of years ago. And they're following up beautifully. It's about 10 years after the end of the previous film. A virus has wiped out most of humanity, but there's a small colony living in San Francisco. And if you recall, that was the setting of the previous film. And at the end of that film, the apes all went into the forest outside the city. Well, they've managed to develop a fairly complex civilization over these 10 years, and the humans are struggling to just survive. And when the humans decide they want to go fix a dam nearby so they can get electricity, they end up encountering these talking, horse-riding apes. And inevitably, this leads to conflict because the two groups don't necessarily trust each other. And Caesar, played fantastically again by Andy Serkis, is the leader of the ape colony, and he's, you know, very wise and actually has a lot of sympathy for humans, but that's not true of all the rest of them. And similarly, Jason Clarke and his little cadre of scientists and engineers are willing to try to work with the apes, but Gary Oldman, as the leader of the human colony, has no time for that nonsense. So it leads to a truly, truly epic confrontation. And it's very, very creatively shot and creatively established. The human characters aren't really that interesting, honestly. The ape characters are much more well-developed.
True.
But just the ideas behind it and the pace of it, it just never slows down. It's incredibly enjoyable, and I really, really pleasantly surprised at how well they're sort of rebooting and restarting this series. So I'm going to give it a 4.
Yeah, the production values are stupendous on this film. The eye candy is great. And you're right, the acting is very good. But more important, I think that this, like all good science fiction, is not about the future. It's about us and now. And it gets at the very roots of war and shows us how these things can come to pass. And it's got a lot of depth. And I'm going to give it a 4 as well. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's a better film this year in theaters so far that I've seen. Actually, I'm going to go one better. I'm going to go 4.5 for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
And there is a canker at the heart of the apes' civilization, the apes' colony, and that's Koba. And Koba is the person who wants to undermine Caesar's more benign outlook upon relationships with the humans. I was curious about the character of Koba. Truly frightening, by the way. Hmm. Although in one scene that's even scarier, Koba launches into a little kind of minstrel show to allay the fears of some of the humans. And he's going to use that ruse to kill them.
Right.
But Koba, think of that. Koba the Dread was what they called Stalin. And that can't be some sort of accident that we have this character, Koba, here. I agree with Loie, too, incidentally. The recreation, if that's the word, visualization of a destroyed San Francisco and the bridge and everything else is amazing. Mm-hmm. And that final onslaught where the apes take on the human stronghold in the city is amazing. I don't care how much of it may be CGI. It looks so real and so
it's
compelling.
Good CGI.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm going to give that one a 4 as well.
Yeah, I'm right with you. So we're all going to agree that Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is definitely worth seeing. And you know what? They do a nice bit at the beginning of the film. So if you didn't see the previous one, you can kind of catch up. They give you a little summary of what's happened so that you don't really have to have seen the first film to enjoy Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, very true. In fact, that opening sequence is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's talk just, or perhaps dismiss quickly, a couple of other sci-fi films that have opened up recently. Transformers Age of Extinction, eye candy of tremendous value, but only eye candy. And it is so stupid. I mean, it's incredible to me that that people have flocked to these movies as much as they have because
they're giant robots destroying things.
It's like,
there's a lot to be said for the appeal of that.
It's like watching a Toys R Us explode. That's basically what it amounts to. And I'm going to give it a 2 out of 5. And the eye candy is all that really is.
Well, and what's really amazing, or maybe I should say dismaying, is when you consider the resources, the incredible resources that go into a picture like this. With the special effects, the design, things like that. I mean, awesome is the word, but for what?
Right.
For what?
Good point. You know, it's to make money, and of course they're succeeding at that.
Yeah.
No question about it. That's Transformers Age of Extinction, rated PG-13. I'm going to give that one a 2. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking about movies, and you can join in on the conversation, 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCURCST. Let us know what you've seen that you would recommend and what you would have us avoid at all costs. There's one that I've really wanted to see that I've missed that I've heard good things about called Snowpiercer. Mm-hmm. I know you and John and Loie have both seen it, so fill us in.
Well, it's the ultimate train movie. And train movies are virtually a genre where put a bunch of people on a train, whether it's the Orient Express or the Snowpiercer, and you get a cross-section of humanity. And this humanity, these are the survivors of a frozen, ravaged planet. And about 2031, I think, is when this is happening. And for 17 years, this train has been circling the globe with its collection of human beings, remnants, survivors. And as we go from the caboose up to the engine, we see a slowly ascending, as it were, order of humanity. The ghetto and the dregs on up to the beautiful people. And then at the head of the train, of course, is the unmoved mover. Loie, did you get that? Do you think the allegory is there? That's Ed Harris, who also has wandered in from his role in The Truman Show.
Ah.
And he is in charge of the train and has ways of his own by which he maintains order on the train. That's one of the more arresting sequences we learn in the film. So we have a guy, Chris Evans, who scowls a lot. Man, does this guy grit his teeth. You wonder if he needs to see a dentist, ultimately. And he's making his way from the tail end of the train up to the engine. And he is doing something nobody else has ever done because he wants to confront Ed Harris. Now, is any of this making sense at this point? You know what? I didn't care. Except for the fact that there's way too much hewing and clawing and hacking away going on in the fight sequences. The allegorical element, obvious as it is a lot of fun. And visually, this thing, as you go from car to car, a triumph of the set designer's art. So, and the ending, which I can't talk about, is very interesting as well. Do you like polar bears? And so I'm going to give it a 3 on the basis of its imaginative design. I don't know the graphic novels from which it was based, but it may have worked maybe even a little better on the page than on screen. But I'm going to give it a 3.
And Loie?
I liked it a little bit better. I agree that it's much more allegorical than anything else, and that whole, you go all the way back to Metropolis or more recently Elysium, where you've got the poor people, you know, going after the rich people in a sort of post-apocalyptic society. But it's got a very stylized look to it. It's based on a French graphic novel. It was directed by a Korean director. It's got a very international cast. And the Korean style, this is Bong Joon-ho, who did The Host and Mother.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a very sort of weird, off-kilter visual style and some great strange characters, especially Tilda Swinton is the sort of right-hand woman of the boss of the train. Visually, it is absolutely spectacular. And I like the action scenes. I think they're very creative, even if they're a little over the top. It is in many ways ridiculous. I wasn't really that crazy about the way it ended. But overall, I thought it was a fascinating film and enjoyed it a lot. So I'm going to give it a 4.
Wow. Uh-huh. Okay. So that's Snowpiercer rated R, and we're giving it a 3.5 rating out of 5 stars. And you're listening to Central Standard right here on KCUR talking about movies. And I would like to dismiss one real quick. And John, maybe you can help me. And that's The Purge Anarchy, which is a sequel to a film with an interesting premise. And that is, in the near future, murder is legal one day a year, and that allows people to get all the violence out of their system so they can live peacefully the other 364 days of the year. And the ideas are certainly better than the execution. In this particular case, the sequel is more of an action film with a lot of bloody mayhem. It's just people killing each other when they get a chance. And to me, it's violence porn, and I'm going to give it a 1.5.
Well, I can't say I liked it much, but I also will have to say I think there are things going on here that are well worth our attention. And that's the fact that apparently behind the whole purge movement is a group called the New Founding Fathers of America. Can you spell Tea Party? This ultra-right-wing group prates its patriotic impulses and the flag and everything else while it kills the poor, while it kills the, I guess what Dickens called, the surplus humanity. The idea of the purge is to, in effect, rid humanity of the dregs. Mm-hmm. So that the wealthy people and the privileged and all of that can survive. I mean, maybe you think I'm overstating this, but the New Founding Fathers of America, to me, was great fun to watch because, man, there is a not at all thinly veiled commentary.
True.
On the ultra-right-wing groups out there who carry their guns and salute the flag. All the while, there's a great mean-spiritedness going on. So Purge Anarchy, I think, in the fact that it trots out that aspect of the plot element, I think is well worth consideration. Now, where it goes, I don't know. They're calling this the new franchise. I don't really believe that. I don't know where you can really go with this thing. A 2 is the best I can do.
All right. I'll join you with a 2 only because the production values were pretty good. So
the New Founding Fathers of America. Keep your eye on them.
Okay,
Russ.
That's the Purge Anarchy rated R, and boy, it earns that R rating. We have someone who's called in who wants to help us dismiss a movie, and we want to welcome Rosemary into the conversation from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rosemary.
Well, hi. I wanted to call in about a terrible movie I saw. I actually wanted a refund on my money, but I didn't ask. But I did pay $8, and I thought it was exorbitant. And the movie is Tammy.
Oh, Tammy.
I'm in complete agreement with you on that.
What a horrible. And I was with other people, and we could hardly stay to sit through it.
You know, I think, yes, Melissa McCarthy, who's the star and screenwriter and producer of this film, is a very talented lady. She's got great comic timing. If you've seen her work in her previous films, I know that you'll probably agree with me, which is probably the reason you went to see it, right?
Yes, because I had heard that, yes.
Well, I thought Sarandon, too.
It was horrible.
But, yes, I completely agree with you. She does a lot of improvisation in her films, and I've interviewed her a couple of times and said, hey, did you ever want to get screenwriting credit? Because you've got to be the one who's providing a lot of this material. And she says, yes, but, the directors ask you to ad lib, and so you do. And this time out, however, she does write the whole thing along with her husband, who served as director. And
I'm sure it was her husband or boyfriend.
Yes.
She was outrageous.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Rosemary. Appreciate you calling and give us a warning on that one.
And I did not like her disheveled appearance at all.
She's not a very likable character in this movie.
No, she is not.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care
Bye.
Now. Bye-bye. All right, so we can dismiss Tammy. I'm going to give Tammy a 2 out of 5 stars simply because I do think Melissa McCarthy is a very, very talented woman, but she's not able to quite carry that one. Let's talk quickly about another sci-fi film that I've heard some mixed reviews on, but we'll get Loie's take on I, Origins. Loie?
I, Origins is kind of a mess. It was directed by Mike Cahill, who did a movie called Another Earth a couple of years ago, which I love.
Good one.
And it uses a science fiction premise, but it's really a drama about two people dealing with grief and guilt. I, Origins is much more ambitious, and it trips over those ambitions on a pretty regular basis. Michael Pitt plays a scientist who studies the eyes, and he and his lab partner are on the verge of a breakthrough, which I'm pretty sure was made a long time ago. But anyway, they think they're going to win the Nobel Prize. And while this is all going on, he meets this beautiful European model who is very spiritual and kind of flaky, and he's sort of fascinated by her and annoyed by her at the same time. But over the years, some very odd things begin to happen that make him start to question his scientific view of the world. And it's visually quite stunning, and it kind of would make, I think I said in my review, it would make a good X-Files episode. Because it's got this very sort of odd quasi-scientific sheen over it, and there's a mystery, and you know, that part's relatively interesting, but it's also very vague, and it kind of dumbs down science and faith equally, and never really says anything, never really gets to a point. You know, I think it's an attempt to reconcile concepts that don't reconcile very well, and you can't do that in 2 hours. So I think maybe Cahill should go back to lower budgets and focusing more on characters, because Another Earth was such a great, you know, start for a director. And I think he needs to kind of rein in those ambitions slightly, because I, Origins just doesn't really work that well. So I could give it a 3.
Three out of five, and that's I, Origins rated R.
Based upon what you're saying, Loie, I wonder why they didn't call it EYE Origins, since it is apparently about the eyes, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised they didn't do that, too. They like their weird puns in this one.
Yeah.
816-235-2888.
So we could browse through titles if we wanted to, I guess.
816-235-2888 is the number, or tweet us at KCURCST. We're talking about movies here on Central Standard. And I want to quickly talk about a documentary that opens today that I got a chance to see, and that is called The United States of Amnesia. This is a film about the late, great Gore Vidal, the last lion of liberalism. It's an interesting and intriguing look at this man's life. There's a lot of video footage of him, so there's a lot of material to use. He, however, had an ego that was as big as his intellect. So if he as a personality is off-putting to you, then this movie is definitely going to be off-putting as well. But I found it to be a relative interesting portrait.
Well, you fooled me. I thought you were going to go to the Roger Ebert.
We'll let you jump onto that one next.
That is life. I don't know. It's one of those titles.
Life itself.
Yeah, based upon a memoir he wrote late in his life. I knew Roger Ebert over the years from the many junkets I went to, and I can truthfully say that he and Gene Siskel truly did not like each other. In fact, attempts by the documentary to kind of soften that at the end of the picture, I think, are well-meant but misplaced. Ebert was an egomaniac, there's no question about it, but this guy was a mensch. You could hang out with him, you could talk with him. Siskel, on the other hand, was a real cold fish. Although he comes off in the film as much more of a humanist, in a sense, than Roger. One thing I regret about the film is that it didn't show us Roger Ebert in some of the other aspects of his world. He was a world authority on British watercolor paintings, on the city of London. He organized London walks and wrote a book about it. You see the book just very briefly in one shot. And I used to talk with him about everything but movies. The guy was an encyclopedia of knowledge about the other arts and their interfaces with film, something that I respected greatly about the man. I think it's a great, great documentary. Steve James was a friend of his, and he also wrote the wonderful Hoop Dreams. And there, I should tell you, there are many, many moments when you are with him in the wheelchair after the operation that had removed most of his jaw. And you're going to find this kind of uncomfortable to watch, but it was Ebert's intention to include these sequences. And so you have to give the film credit for following through on that. But I think it's a really, really arresting portrait of a man who grew from the ranks of a kind of a kid reporter to a world-renowned authority on film, and genuinely so. So I really would recommend this picture, and I hope it stays around for a while so people can get to know Roger Ebert.
And the out of 5 stars?
Oh, I'm going to give it 4.
4 stars mm-hmm. for Life Itself, the story of documentary about Roger Ebert,
right.
And that's rated R. And going back to the United States of Amnesia, yeah. The Gore Vidal
film.
I think it's fascinating because of the fascinating personality that it focuses on. But once again, he's an off-putting person. So that's your reaction to the film is going to be based on your reaction, I think, to Gore Vidal himself. But I'll give it a 3 out of 5.
Well, he was so contentious. You know, I'm
right.
thinking of, was it Norman Mailer?
Yes.
And
there's a very yeah. entertaining scene where these two confront each other.
And similarly, some of the confrontations between Ebert and Siskel, the outtakes on their film review programs, television programs, are also hilarious in the Ebert documentary.
Let's talk quickly, if you would, Loie. I know that you saw a musical, which is kind of an odd duck in cinema these days. It's called Begin Again. Fill us in.
It's not so much a musical as it's just a movie about music.
Uh-huh.
Mark Ruffalo plays a somewhat disgraced independent record label owner who is trying to get his life back together, and he encounters this young singer-songwriter played by Keira Knightley and decides that she will be sort of his ticket back to respectability. But she kind of has her own ideas about these things. And the two of them ultimately collaborate on what they're going to try to do is go out into the city and record live and use that as the basis for sort of a new kind of style. The music's very good. This is from the guy who directed Once, so it's got a good soundtrack. It's just too polished, though. It's supposed to be about authenticity. It's supposed to be about the gritty feel of the streets, but it just comes off a little bit too nice, a little bit too packaged. So I'm going to give it a 3.5, though. I did actually enjoy it.
That's a very high rating, further than I suspected you to go. But that's Begin Again, rated R.
It works despite its problems.
Okay. I think Mark Ruffalo in anything is interesting.
Yeah, he's a good actor. And I want to quickly also talk about another sci-fi. Believe me, we're heavy on sci-fi today. But this one's for kids. It's called Earth to Echo. And it sort of is like what would happen if the makers of the Blair Witch Project decided to make E.T. And so it's a lot of handheld camera work, which I am so through with. I mean, the whole found footage thing is really passe. If someone can come along and figure out a more clever way to do that, a more original way, then I'm all for it. But boy, this does not work. It's okay for kids, but I just wanted to yell at hold the damn camera still for 1 minute. But of course, this is all based on footage these kids were taking themselves.
Show them E.T. instead.
Exactly. E.T., classic, Earth to Echo, not so much. As a matter of fact, I'm only going to be able to give it a 2 out of 5 stars. And before we take a break, which we're going to do here very quickly, let's talk about Obvious Child. It's a movie about a stand-up comic. Loie?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting film. Jenny Slate stars in it, and she plays this very, very, very raunchy, aspiring stand-up comic whose life is kind of falling apart. She lost her job, her boyfriend dumped her, and she has a one-night stand with this nice guy she meets at a bar and finds herself pregnant and decides to get an abortion. And it's handled in a very adult and very matter-of-fact way with a level of honesty that I appreciated. And Slate is very, very funny. She's got a great little group of friends and family around her. It's a little over the top in the raunchiness. There's sort of a too much information level in the scene.
My
really
main
outrageous.
Complaint, yes.
But, you know, it's still very funny. It's very warm-hearted. The characters are likable. And it handles a subject that most people don't even want to go near and does it in a way that probably reflects reality better than any other film that's ever even brought up the subject, and how many of them even do. So I'm going to give it a 3.5.
Yeah, I'll probably give it a 3, but mainly because of the acting. I thought she was very good. I didn't find her stand-up very funny, unfortunately.
No.
They don't want it to be called an abortion comedy, but that's exactly what it is. It's abortion comedy.
Well, it's about other things, too, though.
It is true. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll explore the movie trope of the manic pixie dream girl. Have you noticed this character in movies? What do you think? We'll also have some announcements for you, and we're going to be back in just a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons. I'm joined by my fellow film critics, John Tibbetts and Louie Lockerbie. We're talking about movies that have come out over the last month or so. And also, we're going to be talking about the manic pixie dream girl syndrome. This is a trope that has popped up a lot in contemporary films. The young girl who is happy-go-lucky and sees only the good in life and may not be the most intellectually profound character, but she's there for one specific purpose, and that's to help the male self-actualize. and I know that a lot of people find this very misogynistic and lazy. And what are examples that you'd like to talk about that may be a part of this manic pixie dream girl syndrome? So give us a call at 816-235-2888. Or you can also send us a tweet at KCURCST. I do have a few quick announcements for you in the local movie world. July 27th, there will be a double trouble double feature at the Screenland Armor of The Goonies and Monster Squad. And we'll have more information, of course, on all of these at KCUR.org. Yeah, John?
And I'd like to put in a plug, if
sure,
I may.
Sure, go ahead.
My new book on Douglas Fairbanks and the American Century, is now out, and it's a considerably expanded version of a book I published in 1977 about Fairbanks. And I'm very proud of this, and it's with the blessing of Fairbanks Senior and Junior and his wife.
And you also have a book about
Peter Weir. Peter Weir. Mm-hmm. Peter Weir interviews written while I was on sabbatical in Australia. Would love to talk about it more sometime.
Weir is, of course, the very highly acclaimed Australian director.
Yeah, in fact, the Criterion release of Picnic at Hanging Rock is out now, 50% off.
All right.
I would urge you to check this thing out. It is one of the most visually gorgeous movies ever made, as well as one of the most haunting.
Yeah. A couple of interesting things coming up. The Tivoli, the Royal Shakespeare Company's broadcast of Henry V, Parts 1 and 2, are going to be July 27th and 30th at the Tivoli. There's also some free premiere screenings at the Tivoli to commemorate the 100th anniversary of World War I. BBC America and the World War I Museum present 37 Days, which depicts the events that led up to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. That's going to be August 4th and 9th. Royal Cousins at War is a drama that shows the roles of three cousins, Tsar Nicholas of Russia, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, and King George V of England, and what they did, what roles they played in the outbreak of war. That's going to be on August 16th. More information at KCUR.org. And Rich Hill, an award-winning documentary about three boys living in an impoverished Midwestern town just 70 miles south of Kansas City. This is an award-winning documentary that runs August 8th at the Glenwood Arts Theater. And finally, the Fringe Fest screenings continue this weekend. The Fringe Fest, of course, is winding down now, just a couple of more days. The screenings are at the Screenland Crown Center. And among the titles are The Best of Real Spirit, an award-winning film, films from local filmmakers, a student films. And then we have a documentary called Kansas City Jazz and Blues, Past, Present, and Future. We also have the Smoking Monkey Pictures Music Festival, which is music from Kansas City. The IFC at the Fringe, a lot of short films from local filmmakers. We Are Superman, The Transformation of 31st and Troost, a documentary. And One, which is a film about the individual impact on global humanity. You can find out a lot more information on all of these events at KCUR.org. We'll have that information up on our website very soon. We, again, are talking about movies that have opened up over the last month or so, as well as the trope of the manic pixie dream girl syndrome. And I think we have someone who wants to join in on that conversation. Let's bring in Les. Hi, Les.
Hello.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. I just immediately thought of that. I think it's L.A. Story with Steve Martin and Sarah Jessica Parker. Yeah.
Yes, perfect example.
To me, the original Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, she is not the perhaps most intellectually profound character, but she certainly had a joie de vivre.
Yeah.
And she helped Steve Martin get out of his doldrums.
Yes. Yep. You know, okay, that's all I had to say.
Hey, thanks so much, Les. Appreciate it.
I'm going to argue that this character archetype is really more androgynous. I mean, there's kind of a female identity thing going there, but the sexuality is considerably muted, if not there at all. This is an androgynous character who is a helpmate. And if you're going to look at the female incarnations of it, yeah, I mean, you can go all the way back to the Greeks probably if you want to. Nothing new about this. Audrey Tautou, Meg Ryan, people like that in their earliest films, even maybe Audrey Hepburn type. They're out there, and all we've done is just given them a new name.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that Nathan Rabin has regretted in creating this.
So have I, actually.
In creating this cliché of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And I'm going to give a quote of exactly what he said. Quote, "The characters exist solely in the fevered imaginations of sensitive writer-directors to teach broodingly soulful young men to embrace life and its infinite mysteries and adventures." And he first came upon this idea of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl back in 2005. The film Elizabethtown has that character played by Kirsten Dunst, who helps the male character, again, progress. And he started thinking about this and realized that there are an awful lot of these. As a matter of fact, this topic has become so well known that there's even a young adult novel called Manic Pixie Dream Girl that has caught on. And so are there examples that you can think of? You can give us a call just like Les did at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. And before we go on, let's go ahead and play a short clip from Elizabethtown. This, once again, is played by Kirsten Dunst.
I've always wondered this. Who were they?
You know.
Them.
Them.
Mm-hmm.
The inimitable collective them.
And who says we're supposed to listen to them?
They do!
Doesn't your ear hurt?
Yes, it does.
And I have to get up in 2 hours and be charming.
Going to Hawaii.
Oh, boy. That's Kirsten Dunst lying in the bathtub chatting.
Now I know why I hated Elizabethtown.
Yeah, lots of reasons for that.
Yeah.
That is a character that the writer and director of Elizabethtown has visited before. He did a film a few years ago that was also, I think, a much better film called Almost Famous that had a manic pixie dream girl played by Goldie Hawn's daughter, who's also played that role, but Goldie Hawn's daughter, Kate Hudson, in Almost Famous. It's kind of, well, what do you think, Louie? Is it too lazy?
Well, I think part of the reason Raven's not keen on it anymore is because people have expanded the definition into meaninglessness. I don't think the Kate Hudson character in Almost Famous really fits that, because she's a better developed character. She's got a sadness and a seriousness underneath all of that. He was very specific. The manic part is the unstable, possibly insane behavior that's supposed to be charming. The pixie is that she's just adorable mm-hmm. and quirky. And the dream girl is that she has no sort of basis in reality at all. She exists only in again, as a sort of a imagination, in the imagination of the hero. His definition is very, very specific, but everybody keeps throwing the term around to describe any woman in any movie who has a personality or any kind of joy or whatever, and I don't think they understand what he meant, and I think he's getting tired of people misusing the term.
I think you're right, and I think Charles from Kansas City would like to join in on the conversation. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I was listening to this whole thing, and I don't know if you talked about Sigourney Weaver's character in the movie series Alien. You know, she's really a tough, gutsy, determined type woman. She's strong. She's ready to do anything. She's ready to get rid of the alien. And then there's that other actress that actually, I was talking about the other movie, Gloria, which the first one, I forgot her name, and then the second one, it was a remake of the first one, and that's another
Jenna Rollins?
Woman. Yeah, and then it was a remake. I don't remember.
Sharon Stone.
Yeah, there you go. Well, but yeah, well, I mean, they were both gutsy, determined women. And
Gutsy and,
I
determined,
like
I don't
Stone.
Think are adjectives. Yeah, that he was in.
No, I think you're talking, Charles, you're talking about the anti-Manic Pixie Dream Girl, aren't you?
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, but I mean, these are strong women characters. I mean,
exactly.
So, yeah, it can be done, but, you know, I don't know why they don't do more of it.
Hey, thanks, Charles. Well, appreciate your call.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem. The Manic Pixie Dream Girl is, yeah, exactly the opposite. She's a male fantasy character that's very, well, as John said, kind of androgynous, desexualized, and completely non-threatening.
Let's bring Ruth Ann into the conversation from Central Kansas City. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Hey there. Just reminded you not to forget Tinkerbell, who was quite androgynous but quite charming. Quite helpful.
Although the way Disney incarnated Tinkerbell.
She's definitely not a romantic character, but...
You have to go back to the original writer, sweetheart.
Yeah, true enough.
Oh, gosh. I guess I will have to then.
Hey, thank you,
Most
Ruth
people
Ann.
Think of Tinkerbell, though, from Disney and screen
true
incarnations.
Enough. Thanks, Ruth Ann. Appreciate your call.
Never been called a sweetheart.
Let's talk to Tim from Lenexa. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
I'd like the panel to discuss Ruby Sparks, because I think Ruby Sparks takes up this theme and turns it on its head and shows the author... Yeah, going through the process of creating that girl and then becoming dissatisfied with her.
You're exactly right.
Exactly. We actually talked about that before the show, that Ruby Sparks is a movie that kind of blows up the whole notion, where the guy creates the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and then she turns out not to be what he thought she was going to be and has her own agency. And I think the fact that that was written by a woman really has a lot to do with the deconstruction of it.
And, you know, Tim, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say, and frankly, that goes back to Pygmalion.
Well, it goes back to the Gothics. Be careful what you wish for.
You know, Dan has added on Twitter, Tim, he says, I thought Ruby Sparks was an interesting film because it was written by a woman and it inverted the MPDG cliche.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And, you know,
exactly. It's so refreshing.
You bet. I thought that was a really smart, well-written film. And Zoe Kazan
was brilliant.
She was, and she actually has been one of the proponents of dumping this title of MPDG and has taken Rabin to task over it. And he has written in Salon that he completely agrees with her.
There's just one massive error in the movie, though, at the end when she reappears as the real woman and she looks exactly the same. I'm just wondering how he was going to explain that to all of his friends.
Hey, thanks, Tim. Really appreciate your call.
Sure.
You take care now. You know,
well, she looked the same only to him.
Maybe that's it. Yeah. You know, we're thinking back on films from the past. You know, we talked about Elizabethtown, but there's another example from a recent film, Garden State, which really rubs people the wrong way. I think we have a clip from Garden State as well, and this is Natalie Portman serving to be the Manic Pixie Dream Girl to Zach Braff's kind of brooding character, and here's a quick taste of that.
What are you listening to?
The Shins. You know them?
No.
You gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to, you gotta fill out your forms. Conundrum. Think you could, maybe listen while you fill out
the forms?
Yeah, okay.
It's good, and I like it.
So what are you here for?
What are you here for?
Waiting for a friend, you.
I
that was nosy, I'm sorry. I'm so nosy, I didn't mean to be, I'm sorry.
No, I get these headaches, I just want to have it checked out.
Cool.
Andrew Larchman?
Yes.
We're ready for you now.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Nice meeting you.
You didn't. I'm Sam.
Andrew.
Nice to meet you.
And our producer, Matthew Long Middleton, was talking about the dopey way he says, "What are you listening to?" All right, now there's a pickup line for you. But in this case, it sort of worked. Thinking also back to some of the other examples, some people have talked about Annie Hall, Diane Keaton, as a manic pixie dream girl. However, I think in this case, since she was really based on a real person, she was at least inspired by Diane Keaton, and she turned out in the film to be a stronger person than you might think, that this may be, may not be a sterling example of the cliche.
She doesn't really fix the guy.
Right.
I mean, Woody Allen's pretty clear in that his character is not fixable, and that's not her role.
She does kind of fix Michael Douglas, though, and so it goes.
Oh, boy. Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a minute. But let's go ahead and hear just a little bit of the dialogue from Annie Hall.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
No, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. If you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't. I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah.
Maybe we could add the word mindless to this character, too.
Right. I think that that's probably part of the misogynistic criticism of it is that, they don't really want an intellectual partner. Mm-hmm. This character just wants somebody who's happy to make and help to make him happy. And if she serves that purpose, then kind mm-hmm. of so be it. But while we're on the subject of Diane Keaton, let's go ahead and talk about that film that you brought up, which opens today and is called And So It Goes.
Well, there are those who are bemoaning the decline of Rob Reiner's directorial talents. I would have to add that to the list. And So It Goes. It's a pleasant film, highly formulaic. We even have a birthing scene in this thing, for heaven's sake. But it is a pleasure to watch Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton, although I'm not a big Diane Keaton fan. Every time she sings in the little cabaret and bursts into tears, I want to leave the theater. But it's an entertaining film. It's going to find its audience demographic, I'm sure. It's always a pleasure to watch Michael Douglas at work, and the opening scenes where he's a curmudgeon are pretty fine. He fits that really well. I keep thinking of a movie called Wonder Boys where he played a very cynical kind of character, which I liked a lot. But the best I can do is 2 stars for And So It Goes.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. This, as I was watching this, Hope Springs Eternal, you think you've got 2 Oscar winners, Michael mm-hmm. Douglas, Diane Keaton. You've got Rob Reiner, who's a very fine director and has made some wonderful movies. You also have a screenwriter, Mark Andrus, who did a film called As Good As It Gets, and that was an outstanding film. And you think, okay, this has some opportunity. This could go somewhere, and it just falls completely flat.
It kind of seems like a home movie.
It does.
The locations, the casting, Reiner's in it as well.
Yeah.
There's absolutely, it has that quality.
Yeah, there's not really an honest moment in this film. It all seems very artificial to me. So I'm only going to be able to give it a 2 as well.
I think it's a genre of pictures where people go and talk to tombstones of their departed ones.
Mm-hmm.
How many pictures, we won't, but how many pictures can we think of with characters that do that? Moving on.
Let's talk about Grand Seduction, which is another film that's still in theaters. John?
Lovely, lovely film. Very entertaining. Unreservedly recommended. And as a side issue, I'm glad to see Taylor Kitsch back in a role that I think showcases his talents. John Carter foundered pretty badly at the box office. But a charmer of a picture, a Newfoundland seacoast town trying to lure a doctor to be one of its citizens. They have reasons for this that I won't go into. It's complicated. But the whole town decks itself out to impersonate a place that he would like to come and live with. It's all a deception. It's all a fraud. It's rather ruthless and cynical when you get right down to it. But the film just wins the day with its lovely picturesque qualities of characters and scene. And the great Brendan Gleeson is the mastermind behind the deception that's going to lure Taylor Kitsch to this seaport town. And I'm going to give it a 4. Very entertaining.
Really? Okay, yeah. That's good to know. That's Grand Seduction.
I hope people see it before it moves on.
Right. And I also wanted to just quickly talk about Hercules, which is the dream role for Dwayne The Rock
Johnson.
Did any
of us see it?
I saw it, yes.
Oh,
it's a really beautifully produced film. It's got some great supporting characters played by people like John Hurt and Ian McShane and Rufus Sewell. And, you know, it's got some terrific action sequences. It's kind of a different take. It's the Radical Comics take on the famous story of the demagogue, or is he a demagogue? In this case, it may just be his reputation, and we see the human side of Hercules. It's an entertaining film, and I'm giving it a 3. Boy, you know, the hour has just slipped by, and I want to thank my fellow movie critics, Loie Lockerbie and John Tibbetts, for joining us today. Central Standard returns on Monday with a conversation about graffiti in and around Kansas City and a profile of an artist who's departing for Chicago. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our announcer is Linda Scher. Stick around for Up to Date. That's following us next. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy your weekend.